the legacy of this film is what America thought about itself.
Mm. Mm.
But I don't know if really the legacy is just hot people being hot. I'm not sure.
Listening to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
How are you, Chad?
I'm doing good, Veronica. How are you doing?
I'm tired.
I feel like that's often how we start, yeah.
Is it? Because it feels way worse to me right now.
Anything you want to talk about or just...
Yeah. Let's do it. Okay. I'm flying to Las Vegas next week to officiate the marriage of two of my really close friends from grad school.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I just finalized the sort of ceremony script this week, but between like school stuff, Brightwall stuff, wedding stuff, logistics, and then paying taxes.
Yes.
It has been an extremely difficult couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so excited. I'm like, I could not be more excited to go. But, you know, those times when you're just scheduled to the half hour.
Absolutely.
Like just checking stuff off.
Yes.
So
a lot of people forget that there's good stress. So that all sounds like good stuff, but it still hits the body as stress. So.
Whoa. What is good stress?
How you frame the stress actually makes a big difference. If you're telling yourself this is stress, but it's good stress, then you actually, your body can marshal resources that aren't available to you. If you're just like going, oh my God, I'm so stressed out all the time.
Oh my God.
Now, obviously not all stress is good, but you know, a wedding of a friend would probably fall under good stress. But still, you got to take care of yourself, right?
I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, and I have to imagine it's a nice oasis for everyone today to spend some time in Paul Newman world.
Oh my God, it's been amazing. I've really been enjoying the Twitter.
That's been fun.
If I can say that I'm enjoying our magazine's own Twitter account, if that's not too navel-gazy.
With the Paul Newman stuff, yeah, I mean, that's scouring the internet for cool Paul Newman stuff. And there's just so much. I could do it for a whole year and I wouldn't run out.
I'd be down.
I don't know a person. I'm sure they exist. I don't know a person who doesn't like Paul Newman or doesn't just smile if he comes up onto their timeline or into their life.
It's true.
He's an amazingly singular, galvanizing force for good.
So it's our first issue that's devoted to an actor.
It is. We've done director's issues. We've done like little weird one-offs. We've done one on a movie, just, you know, Margaret a few. So, but we've never done just an actor. So I thought like, well, if we're going to start going down that road, there's no one better to start with than Mr. Paul Newman.
Yeah. Why Paul Newman?
You know, I was talking with Fran Hoffner, who had written this line in her essay that's going to be out in a week or two, where she's just talking about, like, I don't remember being introduced to Paul Newman. He's just always been there as a good force. You know, most of us, I'm sure, grew up with, you know, with the salad bottle dressings,
oh, sure,
all that
sure.
kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So his face was just always there. And then when you realize, like, oh, he's an actor. And then you realize, like, oh, he's in amazing movies and he's an amazing actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look into his life. And that's the thing I most love about why he kind of top of the heap for me in terms of actors is because who he was as a human. I just, I'm not aware of too many lives that have been lived like that, like start to finish and you know, had his fair share of setbacks and traumas and tragedies and things. But just one of the best human beings. I think he's got to be top five all-time human beings. For me, anyway.
Wow.
I don't think you can do a better job as a guy navigating a life than he did.
There's something, you know, it's the kind of like comprehensive stardom that I think Angelina Jolie has too, where it's this magnet for horniness 100%. Like just preternaturally beautiful.
Yeah.
It's mathematically impossible, I think, to look at a star like that and not just be struck in admiration. But then at the same time, there's this whole, like, as you're saying, like humanitarian philanthropy kind of angle. It's more than an angle. It's really reductive.
It was a hardcore belief. Yeah.
Whole package.
But also how the good looks can work. I mean, that was a curse to him, as you know. I'm sure we sit here like, oh, what a curse that must be.
I know.
But it's a curse to be that good looking, apparently. I will never know.
Same.
Yeah.
Fucking same.
Yeah, apparently even like his kids were like, yeah, we just couldn't go out in public. Women would just faint just because he was there.
Wow.
Quite a curse for Paul. Anyway, I'm really excited to introduce our guest today, who we've known for a while, or at least I've known for a while. She is a wonderful person, a big, big Paul Newman fan. And so joining us today is Roxana Haddadi, a TV critic with Vulture, who also writes about film and pop culture there, and whose essays have been actually published many times over the years here at Brightwall Darkroom as well, including writing about a wonderful essay a few years ago on the movie we're all here to talk about today. So I thought, when we decided to do Paul Newman Month and talk about A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I thought there's no better person that I'd like to have on than Roxana. So reached out to her, and she was very willing to come on, and we're very happy to have her here. So welcome to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, Roxana.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I actually did faint earlier as you were just talking about Paul. Yeah, I was like, oh God, that's too much. Now we're here. We'll get through it. The faint's out of the way. So yeah, we're good.
So do we want to jump in, Veronica?
Yeah. Maybe a little movie synopsis.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we are talking about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, directed by Richard Brooks. 1958. So a little plot synopsis. Handsome former football hero Brick Pollitt, played by, of course, Paul Newman, and his wife Maggie, played by Elizabeth Taylor, have driven up from New Orleans, or maybe it's down or over, I'm actually not sure geographically, but driven from New Orleans to celebrate the 65th birthday of Brick's father and the patriarch of their family dynasty, aptly named Big Daddy, played by Burl Ives. Only Brick is hiding out in their bedroom at the bottom of a bourbon bottle, and Maggie is desperately working overtime to cultivate favor from a husband who can't stand her and a family whose resources she needs to persist. This is mainly a film, I would argue, about lying and horniness insofar as Big Daddy has a terminal condition of which he's not yet fully aware, and consummation / reproduction / lineage is always in the foreground thanks to Brick's brother Gooper and his diabolically fertile wife, May.
Always love those. Good synopsis.
That's the ball game.
Yeah.
Roxana, maybe can you talk a little bit about your relationship to Paul Newman and what drew you to writing about the film way back when?
I think that this goes back to something you guys were discussing earlier, which is that I actually have no first memory of seeing this, much like I have no first memory of being like, God, Paul Newman is like the hottest man alive. It's just he was always there.
Yeah.
Practically, I must have watched it on PBS at some time with my parents, because a lot of my early movie watching was on PBS, Saturday afternoon screening.
Oh, yeah, I remember those.
Those were such an important part of becoming an early movie fan. And I think that it must have been in middle school when we were reading Tennessee Williams. Mm. And I think then I realized, like, oh, that movie that I had watched was a play.
Oh, yeah.
So I remember buying a copy of it from our library, like, used a bookstore, reading that, realizing the differences between that and the movie.
Yeah, we gotta talk about that.
Yeah, and just having this early indication of a movie can start as something else and be an adaptation, and what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you lose? What do you gain?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was always very fascinated by that process. And then I had grown up watching some other Elizabeth Taylor movies.
Mm.
Like, we had watched Place in the Sun and we had watched Giant. And so I really just was enthralled by her as an actress.
Oh my, yeah.
Yeah, so I loved them together.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the feeling of Paul Newman being this person that you would consider like the all-American archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Rugged in a particular way, but also sensitive in a particular way. So all of those things sort of combined. And then you have Elizabeth Taylor in what I thought was the beginning of her mad woman era.
Yeah, good call.
When she is just losing it, right? Like, she just cannot take it anymore. And she wants and wants, and Paul doesn't want to give it to her. So there was so much about the oppositional quality of this film that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
So I really have no memory of when that happened.
Mm-hmm. It's just always there.
It's just always there. It's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains perfect every single time.
Mm.
Well said.
Well, thank you.
And I got to ask about, you were going to some cool schools. Did you say you were reading Tennessee Williams plays in like junior high?
Yeah.
Because that was definitely nothing I was allowed to get near at that age.
Yeah. Well, like, so my parents had a lot of leeway. I don't want to say they didn't care what we read. They just encouraged us to read whatever.
That's awesome.
Pretty much through when I was in high school, Saturday mornings from 7 to noon, we're in our local library. My dad would drive us. We would hang out there. Mm. And then he would like give us $5 to roam around the used bookstore in the basement of the library.
That's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah. So I have a lot of old editions of these books.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, and I think I was in middle school and we were doing like a drama unit. Mm. Okay. And I think we read Streetcar.
Ooh.
And I think through Streetcar is when I was like, okay, let me like take a look at some other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like you're reading it early and I'm not sure I really grasped it yet at that time.
Yeah.
And then you revisit it a few years later. It gets better as you get older and put more of your own life on these characters.
Yeah, exactly. And I should ask you too, is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, would that be your favorite Paul Newman, or do you have...
Oh, yeah. I definitely think it's my favorite Paul.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, it's so hard to say.
It's impossible.
Because I also love late life Paul. I mean, I love Road to Perdition Paul.
Yes.
I love Color of Money Paul. Mm. The reality is that Paul was never bad.
No.
Yeah.
You know, even his movies that didn't entirely hit, Paul was never bad. But I think that there is a rawness and vulnerability to his performance here that is sort of unmatched for a long time. And I think him in the rain is just burned into the carnal part of my brain. It's always there. It's just hanging out.
Veronica sent over it the Blade Runner comparison.
Oh, yeah.
I'd never thought about that. And last night, that's all I could see when I watched that scene.
Yeah, as I was rewatching it last night, I was just like, he's giving Rutger Hauer so much for me with those like electric blue eyes. It's mm-hmm. like a color that just feels unnatural.
Yeah.
Almost not quite real. Yeah.
Yeah. Unmatched. Like, I could totally believe him being some kind of sentient cyborg.
More human than human.
More human than I mean.
That's it.
Yeah.
So beautiful that it's like, how was this made naturally? This
I know. Is artificial. I know, it's shocking.
And Elizabeth is the same way, though.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, Elizabeth in this movie. I remember my dad said, shout out to my dad, he was like, I believe in God because Elizabeth Taylor exists.
Wow.
Like, he just thought that she was the most beautiful woman to ever live.
Right at the top.
I love that.
It's like they're both at the peak of their powers in this movie.
So I would say Mr. Richard Brooks got pretty lucky here getting to cast these two people in this movie.
Yeah.
My God. I mean, it's such the play is so good already, but to be able to just say, yeah, let's get Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor in these roles. I mean, come on. It's impossible how good looking those two people are and the chemistry, because, you know, I'm sure we've all seen beautiful people that have zero chemistry together and that doesn't work. Like, this is like 3 minutes into the movie, you're like, oh, yeah, I believe everything about these people already. And there's no ramp up to getting there. You're just hooked right into that chemistry from like right out of the gate. It's just really powerful and like animalistic.
Mm. I think with Taylor, my impressions of her chemistry, of her sensuality, are so inflected by having read and kind of pored over a couple of books about her relationship with Richard Burton.
Yeah.
And just the way that he like wrote about her. He calls her at one point in his diaries an eternal returner of the ball and just like totally bragging about her like sexual stamina and the durability of her sex appeal and how she was the most not just beautiful, but like magnetic woman that he had ever seen when he first laid eyes on her. And that was sort of something that kept them compelled toward each other, even after years and years and through all of the addiction and everything. It's just really... it's so romantic. It's so romantic to me.
Yeah, his diaries are great.
They're great. And there is a kind of like earthiness to her that I think is so good in this film. I know that Grace Kelly was one of the other possible casting choices before Elizabeth Taylor was freed up to do the movie. And while Grace Kelly, I know, was like smoldering under the icy surface, there's still something about Elizabeth Taylor, especially doing the Southern accent and everything, that is very hard to imagine with someone else for me.
Elizabeth Taylor looks like she would slap you in the face and you would like it.
100%.
Yes.
Yeah, like that is just, 100%. Like, I'm sorry to say that. I apologize if that is inappropriate, but that is very much her energy.
You'd pay up. Yeah.
Yeah, like she demands more of you.
Yeah.
And I think that really is the through line through the movie. She wants more. more and she won't be contained. And I just love that feral sort of quality that she brings to this performance.
I totally noticed that feral quality too. And it's such a great contrast with her costuming in the film. The sort of like white slip that I feel like is, at least in my mind, the most iconic, the thing that I associate with the movie the most, even though she's not in that for the majority of the film. But then also, as you write about so well in your essay, Roxana, that kind of deep V in the front and the back kind of chiffon dress that she's wearing that's somehow ethereal and revealing at the same time. I love that. And it just feels like not vampy at all. And yet the contrast between that and her sort of prowling, observant, comebacky kind of quality is just perfect.
She's very aware of what she's doing. Mm-hmm. I think both Taylor is aware of this and her character is aware of this. And so I think it's that sort of manipulation of her beauty. And of course, this is obvious because this is the point of the film. But like, why isn't it working on you, my husband?
Exactly.
And so I think, you know, it's like, it's working on your dad.
Right.
Big daddy's noticing.
Working on your gross brother.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason. And so I think we can discuss this in terms of the adaptation. Mm-hmm. But in that way, I think sort of you notice the changes from the source text and like what would compel those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you perhaps are unaware of the source text, I don't know how much the movie blames that for itself.
That's what I've been thinking a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in terms of the costuming, and I mean, especially comparing that dress with the, what did you call her? Diabolically fertile.
Are we talking about Cooper's wife?
Yeah, May. Yeah. Poor May.
They went out of their way to make her look like mousy. And
yeah.
She wears a sort of like cupcake explosion of a dress that is just repellent.
It is repellent. Yeah, it's like toffee, Empire waisted, perpetual pregnancy dress. Not good.
Yes, Molly Ringwald would destroy that dress in like 40 years.
Yes.
But I mean, the stats there were like she was pregnant with her sixth kid in like 5 years. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
She was on a roll.
Totally.
She's got one mission on this earth.
My goodness.
And it is children. And I mean, and that comes into question with the narrative of the film, right? Like, what do you leave behind? What is the evidence of your life?
Right.
And I think there is a lot of different explanations for what that can be in this film. Elizabeth Taylor's like Maggie is falling into that as well. She wants like proof that she existed. And in the present, that is the lust and adoration of other people. And in the future, it would be like, well, I contributed a child and I had a legacy. And I think those are both very tangible qualities in the film. And then you have Britt and it's like, well, you want something too. It's just entirely different from what she wants. Like he wants to disappear.
Yeah.
And those things are not comparable. I don't know how you reconcile those two things.
No.
And then you get the tension and the great chemistry between them.
Maybe we can gloss. I mean, and by we, I probably mean you, Roxana, because I can't do it. But maybe we could gloss the sort of relationship between the play and the film in terms of the adaptation. Because, you know, I've not read the play, but I've read about the adaptation. And I definitely, along the lines of Alexander Doty's, there's something queer here. I get that something gay has been erased in terms of the relationship between Brick and this Skipper character. And it was reminding me of our conversation from Power of the Dog, the queer structuring absence of Bronco Henry. But he's referred to, there's clearly a fixation. He, we learn, has taken his life by jumping out of a window in Chicago. I'm not sure how long before, actually, how long before the events of the film.
Oh, they don't. I mean, that's just what kicked off all the drinking. But
yeah,
I don't know if they ever, do they ever say?
I think it's supposed to be a couple years.
Okay.
Okay.
So still relatively recent.
Yeah, it's still relatively recent. I mean, that might be imagination, but I think in the play, it's more clear that it's been a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
But this wasn't like just a few weeks or anything.
Yeah, no, no. I think it's supposed to be sort of like an entrenched separation between them.
Yeah.
But my memory of the play is that there is one specific scene and dialogue exchange that we do not get in the film. And if I'm remembering correctly, it is Maggie sort of saying that she saw them together in a certain situation and that her knowledge of that situation, and I think her threatening of blackmail, if I'm remembering correctly, mm-hmm. I think that is what led to Skipper's death. It's either that or she tried to seduce Skipper and he wasn't into it.
I read something last night. If I'm following the chronology right, Tennessee Williams, he was encouraging people not to see the movie. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, he then on the other side of it wrote more for the Broadway productions that came out after that. So both the previous one and the after. So the only version of Cat on a Tin Roof that we've seen in the movie is that movie version is the only version of that. Mm-hmm. But so in one of these editions somewhere before or after, there's this dialogue that I found online that was about Maggie saying to, I guess it must have been Brick, basically saying, yes, we slept together and mm-hmm. we did it specifically because we both thought of you the whole time.
Like, yes, that's exactly it.
She makes it clear, like, hey, Skipper was also thinking about, like, we were having sex together because we couldn't have you, and so we were both just doing it together and thinking of you.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was made pretty explicit in the dialogue, which
yeah.
obviously didn't made the movie cut.
That's like a Gossip Girl reboot plot.
Yes.
Like literally.
Yes. Yes. Although, you know what's so funny is that, and this is partly my bad memory, but also just because there is that absence in the film, it does make it easy for me to be like, well, it was this, or maybe it was this. You know what
right.
I mean? Like
right.
the film doesn't necessarily answer what is the gap between these two people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the movie very much is coasting on like how exceptional these performances are.
Mm-hmm.
Big time.
But I think there is sort of that hollowness that sometimes I think the movie cannot escape.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that Tennessee Williams was like, don't see it. That's fascinating.
Oh, well, I mean, this was like a, you know, however much you believe Wikipedia or whatever, but sure. it said he actually went to theaters and was telling people, you know, don't go and see this.
Wow.
You know, so I, you know, who knows if that's actually true, but I was reading an interview with him in the 70s where he was, you know, just talking about, like, yeah, they cut out the main reason and plot motivator for a lot of this stuff, and he didn't think it made sense, which once you hear the whole story, it's a very fair argument to make of like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't like Richard Brooks' side. It was Hays Code stuff.
Right, of course.
And Paul Newman and Richard Brooks apparently were both really incensed by it, but also they, you know, they couldn't do anything about it. So
right. Yeah.
It would be like leaving out the rope and Power of the Dog.
Mm,
it's like,
right.
You kind of need that.
Right. Yeah. And so like sort of what the movie does is it just makes like Brick, and I think there is some power in this, but it makes him just be like disgusted by mm-hmm. yeah. his family and
mendacity,
the sort of like grubbiness of money mm-hmm. and legacy and yeah. all mm-hmm. that stuff. So he sort of turns against the idea of, well, do you really want me to like run this plantation and run your company and do all these things? And I'm not that kind of man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is power in that idea. We've certainly seen like a rejection of being that son,
mm-hmm.
being the chosen one and not wanting that. I just think that once you know this other storyline exists, it's like, oh, okay, well, that makes so much more sense. It's so much better.
It does.
Yeah. It does feel like it's in there.
Occam's razor.
Yeah. You know? I think it is in there because they still talk about him, but it's just not as much.
They do. And I mean, I think the way you put it, that there's a hollowness that might be sensible in the film, is so resonant with my mm-hmm. viewing of it, which is that
yeah.
the whole plot, I mean, we should say too, this takes place over the course of like one night.
Mm-hmm.
So we start in the afternoon and it seems to go sort of like to, I don't know, like late. It goes late.
Let's say 3 a.m.
Yeah, but yeah. it's still the yeah. same day. And so it has that kind of one day claustrophobia mm-hmm. that I think is typical of a lot of films that are adapted from plays. For a lot of that plot, it's literally just like Brick's father being like, just tell me why you're so messed up.
Yeah.
And Brick being like, I can't, or no, mm-hmm. or you won't understand, or I'm sick of liars, or mendacity, which is so abstract.
Mm-hmm.
As I was watching it, I was just like, yeah, this is super frustrating. It's like, just say the thing that you're so knotted up about. And that sense of, it's not like there's some big central secret that then once it's revealed, unlocks meaning for the film. It's just sort of like given piecemeal, or it's partial. And obviously it has a lot to do with his dead friend and his anxiety about his father not loving him and thinking that his wife betrayed him. And it's so slippery,
yeah.
right? Like there's this absent center that I totally agree makes you focus on the virtuosity of the performances
mm-hmm.
because the narrative itself, just the granular narrative, like there isn't enough friction there.
And it does make Newman's performance, at least for me, particularly impressive
mm-hmm.
because he is shifting between all of these modes
mm-hmm.
and in all of these interactions with so many different family members
mm-hmm.
is really making clear, well, I'm disgusted by you.
Yeah.
And I might not tell you why that is, but I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very tangible in his physicality. He's a great drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh. Throughout the film, you get this sense that he is barely holding it together. But in that, there's so much resentment that I think is very clear. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of ways, it sort of reminds me of Catcher in the Rye.
Mm. I was going to bring that up, but I thought that would have been weird.
No, I think that's true. Yeah, of course.
Cool. He's basically like against phoniness.
Yeah, he's against phoniness. And I do think that we sort of saw the growth of that feeling in this time period, because we did also have like Rebel Without a Cause. I think there is some relevance to that argument in this time.
Yeah.
It just doesn't quite then, for me, reconcile with the ending of the film. So we don't have to jump ahead to that, but I think...
Oh, we always do, Roxanne, by the way. This is the latest we've ever gotten without saying the end of the film.
Yeah, chronology is not a priority for us. So. Yeah.
Our listeners are hip to the spoilers.
Well, then, okay, so then I want to know other people's opinions about the ending. Like, the ending is a baby, right? The ending is Brick being like, you know what, Maggie, you're right. Like, let's just do it. Let's just have a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't quite, you know, and in the play, it's Maggie forcing this situation.
Yeah.
She like locks the liquor away. She's like, no, we're doing this. Like, we're gonna do it my way, which is such a Tennessee Williams thing to do, to put the fate of a family within the hands of this woman who might not know exactly what she's doing, but knows that she wants it.
Yeah.
Mm. Whereas in the film, it is sort of him acquiescing and her swooning. Mm-hmm. And there is more of like a traditionally, quote unquote, romantic end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there is some delight in that, because of course it's two hot people being hot.
About as hot as it gets.
About as hot as it gets.
That lock the door line is...
Yeah. Yes.
Ooh, oh my.
I find it sort of unfulfilling, and I'm curious what other people think.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, I think it's confusing narratively, because throughout the film, he's taking this big stand against lying, this stand toward authenticity, which, like Holden in Catcher in the Rye, I just feel a little like exhausted by, because he is the son of like a super rich plantation family. Like, what are you?
Yeah.
It's too late. It's too late for an authentic experience. You've never had one. Like, don't worry about it.
Your sports casting failed. You weren't good at it.
Yeah. You invented a sports team. Like, no one does that. It's just, there's a little like, woe is me about his whole thing that I don't find tremendously compelling or sympathetic. But then, so if his whole thing is like, be authentic, don't lie. And then at the end, he seems to really recognize the strategy of her lie and appreciate it. And sort of like endorse it. He doesn't out her. You know, the way she's announced the birthday gift is so deranged, when she's like, I have Brick's baby in my body. Like, what?
This is my gift to you.
Jesus Christ. It's just so
amazing.
It's so anatomical. It's so literal.
But she keeps saying it like so plaintively declarative, like, I have it inside of my body.
I know. It feels like Google Translate or something. Yeah, it's just like way too literal. But he's into it. And then I do think it satisfies, some kind of audience desire to see them get it together. And I do find very satisfying Paul Newman leaning against the wall saying, lock the door, which is the opposite diction wise of I have Brick's baby in my body. It's totally euphemistic, totally like oblique, and delivered with Paul Newman's trademark knowingness.
I mean, that might be the hottest line reading he ever gave.
I don't know. Having just rewatched Color of Money several times, I feel like 60-year-old Paul Newman, who can definitely still get it, has a lot of really great lines in that film. Really, really compelling. Like, I was pausing and like just wringing my hands, like taking a layer off. It's just a lot.
Taking a walk. Just being like, I need to walk it off. Like, I need some time.
I got to take a lap.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I do think, Lock the Door is great, but it maybe has more to do with star persona.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Than wrapping up the telling of that particular story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing, so I think that scene in a vacuum is a fantastic scene. Mm. I don't know if it's narratively satisfying or fulfilling. My gut instinct is that it's not. And my morning after rewatch instinct is it feels like kind of grafted on from some other movie. Mm. But I do think another key part, I guess, that we didn't bring up, and I'm not sure how much here got added, but the whole Brick and Big Daddy reconciliation scene, that was none of that was in the play.
Yeah.
That is all added for the movie. They made them add that as well, which, again, think about the dynamics of getting to that end scene where that whole little 10 minutes hadn't happened. I don't even know how that works. And it's been so long since I've read the play that I don't remember. But yeah, so they did a lot of stuff to that third act to kind of get it to where they wanted it to go, I think, as a studio. Or I'm not sure who's responsible for this decision.
But, just the resolutions.
Yeah, so there's a lot of mix. You know, they take out the big central, you know, motivation of some of Paul Newman's drinking and other things in the play. Skipper's confessing his love to Brick on the phone, and Brick hangs up, and then Skipper jumps out the window. So this is a guy who full on thinks, I killed my friend who just wanted to tell me they loved me, you know, and so he's drinking himself to death. And then he doesn't resolve things with Big Daddy, as far as I know. And then you have this scene with this big lie on. So, yeah, I think it loses the plot a little bit.
That must have been so weird for Burl Ives, who plays Big Daddy, because he originated the role on Broadway.
And Ben Gazzara was the Paul Newman Burl.
How weird to play the role and then have the role extended or revised in such a radical way, and then have to play it in a form that would be essentially immortalized, as opposed to the kind of like ephemera of theater, I guess. That must have been so strange.
I just had mentioned to Veronica last night, he's playing 65, but he was only 48 when they shot this.
Oh my gosh.
I, without revealing everything about myself, I will say, Veronica, this person is within 5 years of my age. This is not fair.
Chad did slack that to me last night and was like, we are not going to talk about this on the podcast. And I was like, you are so wrong. We are 100% going to talk about it. I'm glad that you just volunteered it and I didn't have to shine the interrogation light on you.
I couldn't stand the anxiety of wondering when you're going to bring it up.
My God. Yeah, I can't believe that either.
Dude's 48.
I know. God.
That's crazy.
And Newman was only 33. So, I mean,
33 playing 30, looking 25.
Yeah. Just looking young as hell.
Yeah.
Man.
I know.
Just the part where we just make noises about how hot he is.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of contemplative pauses in this episode, I think.
This is the pause where we all take a break to take a walk. We can just walk it off and then come back.
Yeah, hey, Eli, can you mute the mics? We need to all go take showers.
I really want to go back and read and see if there was like contemporaneous coverage of the production at the time.
Oh, there has to be.
And what people were saying. I'm sure there has to be. Mm. I'm wondering if it was also as reductive as me being like, they're hot, you know? All I was going to say is that it is unfortunate, and I guess I do sort of believe the Tennessee Williams being like, don't see this, because the reconciliation and the screw it, let's have a baby are both so at odds with the play.
With the narrative design of the whole play,
With the play, which is just like about the failure of the American family and the American dream, and the sense that marriage and a child will save you. I mean, Tennessee Williams was, at least by my understanding of his work, vehemently against that idea in like everything he wrote.
Not a fan,
Not a fan of that. So I can totally understand being like, no, actually, this diminishes my work.
Well, then this becomes like one of your best known things about you is something that took your art and changed it. I mean, he got over it. He had many successful.
Yeah. No, he kept going.
Plays and movies. You know, I don't think he had any problem with Streetcar Named Desire as far as I remember. So
yeah,
he had a good career still. But yeah, that would definitely stick in your craw a bit as an artist, I have to imagine. Of like, but that's not the thing that I wrote.
And it is sort of interesting to me that it was only a 3-year gap between the play and the film.
Yeah, really close together.
So close together. You know, I don't know if we do that now. I feel like we have a lot more time between projects because we're always trolling for recognizable IP. And so like, as much as there are a lot of things that are adaptations that we recognize, there's just something interesting to me about the immediacy of a 3-year turnaround, but a 3-year turnaround that changes the fundamental core of your work. That's sort of fascinating.
That's got to be fairly unparalleled, that last part.
Yeah. And with theater, too, as opposed to a novel or something, because as you're talking about it, I was like, well, what about the Sally Rooney adaptations on Hulu, which are happening pretty quickly? I mean, not within 3 years in terms of conversations with friends, but pretty quickly enough that it might be doing that thing where, you know, a novel gets reprinted with the stars of the film on the cover.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that becomes the sort of recognizable visual vocabulary for the characters. But with a play, how extra weird, right? Because that's already embodied. That's already being performed and enacted and kind of brought to life in a particular way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe it speaks to the appeal of Newman and Elizabeth Taylor at that time.
Yeah, we just have to keep coming back to that. That's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we keep coming back to that because I, you know, man, if I lived back then, I'd be like, hell yeah, let's buy some tickets.
It's like magic, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there, Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
There wasn't this amount of sexuality even hinted at, really. I mean, this felt like way more sensual and direct, even though it was still haze-coded.
Mm-hmm.
In, like, 1958 movies weren't doing this, Veronica or Roxana, were they? I don't know.
I think that's a...
Indiscreet was the same year, for reference. I don't know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is also, like, pretty racy. I think there is a common misconception that under the Hays Code, Hollywood studio productions were sexually antiseptic.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of what the Hays Code prevented was more specifically in relation to the idea that film audiences were susceptible to bad ideas.
Like morally?
Exactly. And so mm-hmm. they were more ideologically controlling. So it would be something like removing an explicit suggestion of a homosexual storyline as opposed to something that would sell a lot of tickets and have a real kind of economic motivation, which is amplifying the sexual chemistry between these two co-stars.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much about like not wanting there to be or not permitting there to be sexual suggestion on screen so much as who can, like what kinds of behavior are reflective of like family values, which I think, you know, is interesting because it speaks directly to the film too. There's obviously this like insane amount of fucking that is implied by yeah. Cooper and May
mm-hmm.
and their relationship. And it even gets kind of talked about at the end of the film in this really shocking way.
Mm-hmm.
And his name's Gooper.
And his name is Gooper. What does that have to do with anything?
You have this very smart, erudite sentence, and then you have to say Gooper.
Gooper. You know, when they're on the stairs at the end of the film and May is increasingly off the rails and yeah. the running joke is that Cooper keeps telling her to shut up
mm-hmm.
and she's just pushing it by suggesting that she not only does not hear Brick and Maggie having sex at night in the family home where doors are meant to be unlocked. But what she does hear is her begging him to have sex with her and him refusing.
Yes.
Right.
You know? And then he says, what does he say? Something like, not all of us
are as loud as you.
Yeah, we don't advertise our love. Yeah.
Precisely. So it's some kinds of reference to or evocations of sex, like 100%, and particularly if it was ending up in a kind of like reproductive futurity. But yeah, something as sort of meandering and indecent as whatever these football heroes were doing
yeah.
after practice, that's not gonna make it in the final cut.
I really love that moment because May, like, having so many children, I feel like there is one version of this story that is just like, well, she exists only to like have these kids and there's no sense of what could be her own desire or her own pleasure. But that is sort of an allusion to the fact that, like, she likes the process, right? And she is, like, paying attention to what other people do
mm-hmm.
and how they do it. So it's interesting, too, to have that allusion of, like, she is enjoying it
mm-hmm.
and sort of digging in Maggie's eye that she is not.
Right.
And so I love that there's this cruel
yes.
sense of competition between the two of them. There's a lot of cruelty in this movie between mm-hmm. almost... almost everyone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Big Daddy seems to hate his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to hate almost everybody. Yeah.
He seems to hate almost everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie, to her credit, hates her nieces and nephews.
They are terrible.
They are terrible, and she hates them. And so there is all this anger in this movie. You know, I don't like to say that anger and sexuality go together, because I think that can be a toxic suggestion. But I think this movie does a good job showing how heightened emotions of any kind
mm-hmm.
can swing in these various directions
mm-hmm. oh, yeah.
that are, as you mentioned, Veronica, like sort of like earthly
mm-hmm.
and tangible, I think, in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wrote about this in my essay, is you get the sense that like there's a storm gathering
yes.
inside and outside
mm-hmm.
of this location.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, for whatever flaws it might have, I think gets that atmosphere and aesthetic correct.
I think that's so right. And it's so American South to have the summer storm ambiance. I mean, it feels heavy-handed to me a little bit, but as a devotee of Written on the Wind, I feel like some heavy-handed weather totally okay by me. But we do get some pretty like melodramatic, you know, thunder crashes and stuff like that as things are heating up in the house and outside the house too, as you observe. That's so smart.
Mm-hmm.
I know Veronica had mentioned in the show notes too about both both the melodramatic aspect, but also the fact that it all takes place in like a 24-hour period, which I had probably hadn't watched this in 20 years before last night. I had forgotten that the whole thing in school, in my mind, it was like a weekend or like a long week, but it's like, I don't know if anyone's done the math. It can't be more than 24 hours from that first scene. And,
it's less.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you count him running the hurdles as the first scene, I don't know.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah. But basically, it's all, you know, if you count that as a little mini prologue, then you could say the whole thing's like less than 24 hours.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't stop, which I love how Veronica had said was, you know, fascinating and exhausting. There is like an exhausting mm-hmm. aspect. Like, can we have a scene where it's just a little bit less, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit, dial it back a little bit.
Yeah. It's so noisy.
Yeah. It doesn't stop.
Yeah, it is a lot for being so, I don't know, not exactly bare bones, but sort of simple in a certain way. There's so much, especially at the beginning of the film, to sort of set the scene. There's so much chaos and noise and porousness of the rooms onto each other and the verandas and everything. And it just feels like you can't escape and everyone's eavesdropping on everyone else. And, you know, it's 1958, but it reminds me of so many like large family homes that I've visited or been to where there just is this constant sense of an audience or something. And there is nowhere to sort of hide except for when Big Daddy goes down to what reminded me of like Citizen Kane's Xanadu, like this cellar full of weird.
The cutout. He had the sports cutouts on the.
Yeah, the sports cutouts.
He starts hitting his own stuff with the crutch. It's great.
But also some like Ming vases. I mean, there's just like a whole antique roadshow. What's going on down there?
He's got a little Etsy store.
Yeah, it's like a little hidey hole. Yeah, and I just love that we like start at the top of the house and kind of just go down and end up in the base level of the house. I love that.
In the place where things are forgotten mm-hmm. or lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And have to be reckoned with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and have to be faced. Yeah. And I also, something that I think is really interesting, and I have sort of thought about this, and this is a little silly, but like they're gonna be awful parents, right?
Oh yeah,
like they're not gonna be good.
Oh my god, can you imagine? It's like poisonous breast milk.
This is going to be horrible.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's funny too, like there is that layer of, okay, like I guess this is a nice ending sort of that they have reconciled.
And they're kissing.
That's great. I love to watch these two people kiss. Give me more of that.
Yeah.
But thinking about like, man, that kid is maybe gonna be
no chance,
just as screwed up as they are.
I'll take the maybe qualifier out of there.
Yeah.
That kid will be as screwed up as they are.
And the play makes that clear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, so there mm-hmm. is just this sort of interesting idea of like what happens to a piece of art when you change its entire identity. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, the legacy of this film is the sense of place and the sense of time and what it was sort of saying about what America thought about itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if really the legacy is just hot people being hot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Well, Twitter has definitely boiled it down to lock the door. So
I guess that's true. I guess it's just hot people being hot, which has a time and a place.
Well, and that's why I love that line, which I had forgotten completely. So I was just, I think I did actually laugh out loud for real in one of her complaints in the beginning when she is just begging him to maybe not be so good looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just love what she's
getting. Couldn't you just lose your looks?
Couldn't you just not be so good looking?
Yeah.
Again, no one's ever said that to me.
Come on. I don't believe that.
I've always had to deal with that one.
I mean, if you're comparing yourself to Paul Newman, all of us are going to lose, you know? It's not like the rest of us are very close to looking like Paul.
He's on a different plane.
Yeah.
And also, I guess we haven't said one of the more famous little trivia aspects of it, where the director insisted on filming it in color because of the color of Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor's eyes. He's mm-hmm. like, we have to do this movie in color, which is just amazing to think like, no, just because they were so attractive, the director's like, we got to do this one in color. This will work way better.
So true.
We don't want to hide. Yeah. It's just, I'm trying to think of a parallel where a movie made. I mean, there's other artistic reasons often for mm-hmm. movie between black and white and color in that era. But to just say, no, these people, come on. we got to do color.
That's knowing your audience. That's knowing what the people want.
Yeah, I would say he made a correct calculation. Yeah.
Absolutely.
What Veronica has thought of as the Blade Runner scene in the rain. The eyes there, it almost seems like a special effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, anytime that shows up on my, you know, social media feeds of any kind, mm-hmm. I always just think that picture looks doctored even because it's impossible mm-hmm. that eyes can look like that. But mm-hmm. there they are and we get them forever.
So. But even the rest of the film, I mean, the lushness of the plantation mm-hmm. yeah, is rendered so well in color. I mean, you do get the sense of this is what they're fighting over.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's Maggie and not Brick. Brick doesn't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Maggie sees this and sees the lushness. And I think there is that sense of, well, if I can't have a child, then I can at least have this thing, mm-hmm. which is vibrant and alive. And you get that in color. You get the white dress in color, the mm-hmm. starkness of that white against the rest of the interiors of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we've talked a lot about the narrative and the performances, but the rest of the technical craft of this movie
mm-hmm.
is very beautiful and well done. And I think it does insert you into this family and all of their shortcomings and failures and how this space captures that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think this is horrible to say, I do think it's the best of the Williams adaptations, despite essentially changing the play.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. But so I would say to you, is that, again, back to because of the performances, or what do you think allows it?
I think
just the craft in general?
I think the craft in general. I think the performances, I guess this is where I say that, like, I'm not super a Brando person.
Okay.
And so I think that there is a humanity to the performances in this film, even though they do sort of veer into melodrama and arguably unintentional camp. I think there is a openness to them that just allows me to fall into the film every single time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it invites you in by placing you and immersing you
mm-hmm.
very effectively. That is incomparable.
I think it works really hard to do that. Just even the opening credits, as soon as I turned it on, like, it felt like, you know, my line, I always say, it felt like a movie, you know, right away. It sets a mood very, very mm-hmm. well. And then just really just turns it up from about 3 minutes in. It's just been nonstop till an hour and 48 minutes. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I think as much as it's about, at the end especially, like, hot people being hot, as we've said, there's also something really compelling about this moment early in the film when Maggie is worried, or she's trying to ask Brick to sort of reconsider just giving up all of this inheritance, the possibility of it. And she says, you can be poor when you're young, but you can't be old and poor. What she clearly means is that, like, her youth and beauty are also a kind of currency mm-hmm. and that you need less also maybe when you're younger, there's more possibility in front of you. But she knows she won't have it forever. Like, there's this acknowledgement of the temporariness of what she has, which is sort of genetic lottery and probably a lot also of, like, well-honed performance of upkeep. I mean, God knows. And knowing that it's going to take more than that ultimately to, like, age and get sick and be cared for and sort of, like, live in the world is something that Brick doesn't understand because he's always had those resources yeah. and also doesn't understand because he's beautiful and probably will be for longer.
I mean, he was for long. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was beautiful forever.
Forever. Yeah. I mean, even when you're talking about his blue eyes, I was like, I really do prefer late game Paul Newman just aesthetically because there's almost something like too uncanny
yeah.
about how he looks when he's younger. It's like too beautiful or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's no patina on it whatsoever. But then when he's older, you see a little more life experience. There's a little more texture.
Oh, yeah. Scorsese has that great quote about that he's still the same, but he's got, you know, he's lived now. You can, like,
yeah,
it's the same guy, but you can just yeah. feel more in his eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you also get that with Redford.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Who, you know, mimicked so much of his career off of what Newman had done.
Yeah.
Right.
So you reach a certain point for these men where you're like, okay, now you feel like a real person. You feel like yeah. some things have happened to you
mm-hmm.
that I can relate to. I have some wrinkles too. We've both seen some shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now we can sort of get into what life is.
Who do you see making that transition? Like, who's around 40 or 50 now?
Ooh.
I think Ben Affleck's going to try. I don't think it's going to work.
Mm.
But who's going to actually successfully maybe make that transition?
I think Dana Stevens wrote about this recently. She wrote about Chris Pine.
Ooh, good call.
As yeah. sort of our next, like, you're incredibly hot.
Mm.
Your eyes are incredibly blue. And how do you sort of age into being a character actor? Brad Pitt tried it, and I think has mostly succeeded.
I think he actually does, yeah.
And he has always sort of been compared to being a character actor with leading man looks.
Mm-hmm.
Veronica spoke about this earlier, but I think that his image management has been very well done.
Yeah, for Brad Pitt we're talking
for
about.
For Brad.
Yeah.
I think that he has long cultivated this sort of roguish charm that might not necessarily be who he is in real life, but we certainly think of him in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like the best example of this was Spy Game,
in
which he was with Redford, and there was sort of like a handing of the torch.
Yeah, I love that movie.
That's a good movie.
I don't know who the next Brad is. I think that Chris Pine is sort of trying to be like the next Redford and age into sort of more serious character actor work.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, and this is a reductive thing to say, but whatever, I'll say it, is I think that, you know, the reality of acting now, at least it seems to me, is that you don't do a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a lot of other life experiences. I think a lot about like Harrison Ford working as like a carpenter and these other people doing these other jobs that sort of gave them other skills and other facets of their personality.
Or having to be in the Army or the Navy or the, I mean, just life experience.
Yeah, just having other shades of life. I don't quite know if actors now have to do that because of whatever, it's competitive in a different way, or you're just doing the like training to Netflix show pipeline. But I do think there is something lost there, which might be reductive. I don't know.
I think it sounds fair.
I think it's hard to say who could be the next Newman, who could be the next Redford.
Yeah. And to be fair, in my mind, there's no next Newman. He's a singular unicorn. But yes, I'm interested in the trajectory as, you know, just kind of following how stars' careers go.
Yeah.
Because I'm not even just talking about the acting, I guess, as I think about it. Just even the whole shape of the career. Like, I mean, he just kept reinventing, or at least I know he famously attributes almost everything to really good luck.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a great line, I think it was Pauline Kael, but if not, it was someone of that ilk, who said, like, but what he did with that luck was what made him this amazing human. You know, I mean, he's given away more money than any actor, I think, probably ever, and created, you know, this whole summer camp and named it the Hole in the Wall Gang. They've served over 100,000, you know, kids with life-threatening or terminal illnesses that get to go to a free summer camp and just have fun. I just can't even think of anyone comparable in the world who's done so many good things and had almost every business thing they tried just work really well. Like, he's truly a blessed guy. Patricia Bosworth did a Vanity Fair profile on him in like 2008, right before he had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, the coolest thing about him is that it almost seemed to just never occur to him not to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
I just get a feeling he was a real good guy. Plus, it seems like he was a great hang. Like, it seems like his favorite thing to do is like drink beer, get on the boat and just have fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there was sort of an attempt at this with Brad and Angelina.
Yeah.
This sense of like, we can be famous, we can be A-list, our relationship is part of the appeal from like a public facing perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But like, time has not bore that out as well.
No.
So I think there's also this sense of the longevity of Newman's appeal is that not much seemed to change in his personal life.
No.
He was someone who cared about this stuff from the beginning and he kept caring about it. He sort of was unaffected, I think, by the changing world around him, and that he had a core set of principles and he maintained them.
Yeah, he was at the march in Washington. He was like campaigning against the Vietnam. He was like, whoever was going against Joe Lieberman in Connecticut Senate races.
Right.
He always jumped in and he didn't care about a lot of the, I mean, he put a lot of stuff on the line and for always for principle, never for like personal gain or look at me, or again, just such a rare species of human and actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked great with a beard and clean shaven.
It's true. True adaptability.
Could not mess that face up.
Who can you say it about, you know?
Yeah. And the last thing I would just say is watching The Verdict, which I'm writing on this one, he's also playing a drunk in that. So to watch these movies back to back that are like crazy, less than 30 years apart, but same guy in every way, but just completely hollowed out and can play vulnerable so well, which is so hard for someone that looks like that to do.
Mm.
And that really, you know, ushered in this whole other phase of those late Newman performances and Color of Money. And even like, I don't know if you guys have seen Absence of Malice with Sally Field. Great little movie. I just struggle to think of a time when it didn't work. But I also think it's important to realize he didn't really start, like Cat in the Hot Tin Roof was when he kind of became big.
Mm-hmm.
By the time HUD comes along, he's in his mid-30s. And a lot of actors, I think, would benefit from having their careers really take off in their mid-30s instead of their early to mid-20s.
Whereas with Taylor, it was her early. I mean, she was a child actor.
Yeah.
Taylor at the this point is so established. She's what, like 20 years into her career already, I think?
National Velvet was like 13, 14 years old.
She started as a child and continued onward. So it's interesting to look at this film in terms of where does it place each of their trajectories. Taylor was already established, and then this sort of ushers in a different affect for her in terms of going back to that mad woman ideology. I think she showed that she could do something different, and then that sets her on a different path. And then with Newman, it's like, okay, you're established as incredibly hot man, and what else do you want to do? I like looking at this film and looking at the rest of their filmographies before and after to understand its placement in terms of how they progressed and developed afterward.
Oh, I never thought about that, because they both really took off on a couple of very different 10-year runs from this point.
This is pre-Cleopatra, of course, pre-Virginia Woolf. But I think Elizabeth Taylor sort of digs into this uncontrollable element of herself in a certain way after this point.
Maybe this is a good time for last call. So every episode we end with a wrap-up segment where we ask our guests, in this case, Roxana, for the last thing you watched recently, not this, and then a quick staff recommendation of something that you would put out there for other people to consume.
What I watched most recently, movie-wise, pre this, was Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Ooh, everyone's talking about that.
Yes, everyone's talking about that. I expected to be emotionally sort of moved as the child of immigrants and someone who can like look at a lot of facets of that story and feel personally touched by them. But even with that expectation, it sort of blew me away from a performance and imagination level.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I really enjoyed that. I would say if you can see it in theaters, do it. And then my recommendation is for an upcoming series, which is going to be on Stars. It's called Gaslit, and it is about Watergate, but sort of from the perspective of not Woodward and Bernstein. It is looking at Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of Nixon's attorney general. Someone who, from the beginning, when Watergate happened, was like, no, Nixon was behind this. And Nixon and her husband ordered her detainment and essential, like, kidnapping and forced drugging.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
It is a wild story.
Blowing Veronica's mind.
Yeah. Delighting me to no end, obviously.
Yeah. It is so incredibly bleak.
And this is a docudrama or an actual like dramatic series?
This is an actual dramatic series. It's Julia Roberts as Martha Mitchell.
What?
Did Ryan Murphy direct it? Or
no, it is Matt Ross, who did Captain Fantastic.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Cool.
You know, it is, again, this is a wild story. And I think that they actually do a good job sort of making it more sinister and uncomfortable once you get past that, wait, Nixon did what? I think it sort of digs into an acknowledgement of sort of the wide, far-reaching network he had and the loyalty among those people who made up that network.
Yeah.
So I found it very compelling, and it has a great cast, including Dan Stevens and Hamish Linklater and Betty Gilpin and Sean Penn.
Oh my goodness.
And Shea Whigham.
When does this come out? As you know, we're not usually up to date on anything at Brightwell Dark Room. So this is like, feels like breaking news to me.
I wrote about Emily in Paris right after it came out, Chad, so.
You did. Okay. That's
she was really on top of it.
You know. Come on.
Veronica is very on top of that. I am not. So when does this come out?
This is on Stars on April 24th. It premieres.
Okay.
And it is executive produced by Sam Esmail.
Ooh, nice.
So it has that sort of like Mr. Robot,
cool,
homecoming sort of like paranoid aura.
And are you writing about it?
Yes, I am reviewing it for Vulture. So
awesome.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. That's my rec.
Nice.
I'm excited to see that. And I didn't know existed like 2 minutes ago.
Stars is a network. I think Stars.
Oh, I knew Stars existed.
Well, I've had some free 30-day subscriptions to Stars before.
Stars is definitely a network where I'm like, I like a lot of what you put out, but nobody knows that you're putting it out.
Yeah.
So maybe up your marketing.
I mean, Julia Roberts. Wow.
She was great.
That's awesome.
She is great.
All right. Well, thank you for that recommendation. That's going to be fantastic to check out. And thank you for being here in general today. It was such a treat to have you on the show and for talking through Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with us.
Thank you so much for joining us.
This was really nice, you guys. I really enjoyed seeing your faces and having this conversation.
And it's so nice to meet you.
Yes.
Finally.
After all these years.
We've been mutuals for years.
Of our various social media correspondences.
Yeah.
I've never seen you. So to not have to type my words to you is nice. Yes. To just be able to talk with you. That's
agreed.
Great.
Agreed.
And anyone who wants to check out any of Roxana's essays, I looked, she wrote 10 of them for us over a couple of year period. Some really fantastic stuff in the archives. If you find one of her pieces, just click her bio and you'll get all the pieces on our site. But can you tell us where your writing is available elsewhere? Anything else you want to promote or talk about yourself?
Sure.
This is the time.
You can find my work at Vulture, and you can find me on Twitter at Roxana_Haddadi. And yeah, I mean, I am so proud of the stuff that I've written for you guys. So I would say if anybody wants to dig into some of that stuff on Annihilation or The Crow or Road to Perdition, that would be awesome.
You've read about two Paul movies. I always forget The Road to Perdition.
Yeah.
Nice.
Great stuff in there.
Thank you, guys.
Absolutely.
Awesome. We're going to link to those in the show notes.
Cool.
And then to read this month's Paul Newman issue, you can visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. And find us on Twitter at BWDR.
And if you haven't already, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Share the show with a friend. Tell a movie lover in your life about it. Tell your mom or dad about it. Just tell anyone you know. And also, please consider leaving us a positive rating or review. That's, as they say on every podcast you listen to, the number one way to bring attention and metrics and all these other words that we don't fully understand to us. So please do that thing. It helps us so much and it helps us reach more movie lovers like you.
Yeah, we want to get on some PR lists. We want some free stuff.
Yeah.
I want to get in that TCM wine club if they're still doing that. You know?
I will Google that.
So in addition to rating and reviewing, which please do, I think our rating is like 4.6. We can do better, you know, just boost us.
Well, we can also need more of the ratings,
Yeah. The best way to support the podcast is to visit patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Bye. I think we got a harmony on that.
Oh.
Because I was a child of the early thousands, my main association with Paul Newman is him as Doc Hudson in Cars.
Yes.
We didn't get to the animated Paul.
Yeah.
Doc Hudson's eyes are still blue, though.
Yeah. Very blue.
I wonder if he was like, this is my condition or something. Wouldn't that be amazing?
I could have done the full hour on just his whole race car career. Like, that's just a fascinating thing to take off into.
It is really funny that, like, every 3 months, those photos go viral on Twitter again.
It's I know. Like, I know. Time. Everyone discovers that Paul Newman is hot on Twitter, like, every, like, 4 months.
And that he was, like, winning Daytona races in his 70s. Like, he wasn't, like, casually into, like, driving cars. He was, like, hardcore, get me off the film set, get me racing cars for the next 3 months.
No. I mean, like, we're never going to see another one like that.
Such a man. Never again. I know. Yeah.
Even the physicality in his performance in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is impressive.
Yeah.
Like, when he's jumping hurdles in the opening.
I know. He falls down, like, 18 times, like, on his face.
Like a champ.
And he beats his own picture with a crutch and he, you know, throws stuff at people. It's great.